My name is Michael Pellett, and I teach philosophy up at the University of Saskatchewan in Saskatoon, Canada, and I'm also pastor at a shared ministry congregation comprised of a Lutheran congregation and a Presbyterian congregation in Saskatoon. And this week, what we're looking at here is kind of theology / literature studies, looking at some treasure tales, treasure parables that are told around the world, and then linking them up each day with one parable that Jesus told that has a treasure theme attached to it, and one of the things that are there. And so what we did yesterday was introducing ourselves to the things about treasure. First of all, a little poem from that cynic, Emily Dickinson, from which you can see we get the title for these sessions. Finding is the first act, and as you knelt there, she goes through talking about treasure. It's the sense treasure isn't what we always think it is, right? And she has great suspicions about treasure, and finally, perhaps, treasure and everything connected with it is a sham. On the other hand, she also says, blessed are they that play, for theirs is the kingdom of God. And so we will be playing with some of these treasure tales in order to try to ascertain what the meaning might be for us and the kind of twist that Jesus puts on his treasure parables, and again, the kinds of meanings that are there. As one looks at these treasure stories and treasure parables, I'm saying one the things to pay attention to as we try to figure these things out are threefold. First and foremost is the plot, right? What moves the story forward? And we'll see in Jesus' parable, like the treasure that was buried in a field, it's a two-sentence parable, and yet it has all these elements of plot. And so in any treasure story, it may have all of these, may only have some, but there is hiding, seeking, finding, obtaining, securing, and then once you have the treasure, may or may not talk about how one uses it. But these first five items of plot are key. And so what we'll be doing each day is looking at one of these major understandings within the plot. So yesterday we talked about hiding. Today we're going to be seeking. Secondly, we need to pay attention to the actors in the story, right? The agents, those that make the action move. And third, the various items that are the background for the action, right? Like, why is there this magical animal, or why this god, or why do we have, as we look today, the importance of dung? And we'll look at today. We see that Jesus is telling us a PG-13 parable, and again, all our translations try to make it very nice, so it's not quite as scatological as it really is. And so, therefore, when we talk about the plot, and what I'll introduce today in just a bit, is that we've got our hiding, seeking, finding, obtaining, like here, but in each one of these movements between hiding and seeking, seeking, finding, or finding, obtaining, what can complexify the plot, and of course what will make the story more interesting, is there will be a contest or a competition. And you can see how that will come through right away, is if something is hidden, already now we've got the contest, the game, who can find it? Right? Kids play hide and seek. There's your contest, your competition. I'll hide the treasure. Can you seek it? Or again, in hiding and seeking, we'll find so often that one will come upon the treasure, or the seeking is just going to be pure luck or accident or chance, right? Kind of synonyms for that. Or at times, that seeking and what may happen there will involve providence or fate or destiny. In other words, the gods will smile kindly upon you. And so the gods will help you find that. Or at times there are certain superstitions and taboos that you can go through to help in the task of seeking or finding or obtaining. And lastly, what could happen is a sense of paradox, where one is engaged in seeking without finding, or finding without seeking. And of course, this is the most complex and somewhat frustrating way of telling a story, and of course, the way Jesus tells the parables, and especially the treasure parables. They all involve a sense of paradox. And again, I think one reason why Mark tells us in his gospel, for example, that Jesus speaks to the crowds in parables, but they do not understand. Because it's very difficult to come to a full understanding and meaning of paradox. And so again, we'll be looking at a parable today, which will also give us this sense of paradox. So to look at some understandings of seeking. And of course, if we're going to go seeking for treasure, there can be methods and techniques for successful seeking. All our typical kind of pirate treasure stories. If you're going to go after the buried treasure, what's the one essential thing you need to find the treasure?
A map,
right? You can't go treasure seeking without a treasure map. So that's going to be essential, and you can see how that comes out in some treasure stories. Or you might be able to find treasure if you go high tech and you have metal detectors. But again, more ancient treasure stories also had metal detectors, but they didn't call them metal detectors. They were divining rods, right? And divining rods are the good old-fashioned metal detectors for treasure seeking. And here's an old Anglo-Saxon recipe for constructing a divining rod. And so, of course, you may want to take this down. It will be valuable for you. Here's the recipe. Take 9 steel rods, about 10 or 12 inches in length, sharp or piked, to pierce into the earth. And let them be besmeared with fresh blood from a hen mixed with hog dung. Then make, don't laugh, come on, this is serious stuff. Then make 2 circles round the hid treasure. One of said circles a little larger in circumference than the hid treasure lays in the earth. The other circle some larger still. And as the hid treasure is wont to move to north or south, east or west, place your rods as described. There you go. Recipe for finding treasure. What do you think?
It sounds like they already knew where it was.
Well, you usually have a sense. Remember, you might have a map, or you might have a tradition or story.
The divining rod confirms it?
Huh?
The
And the divining rods are what you're going to use to confirm it. Just think about that in terms of divining rods for finding water, right? You sort of think, I think there's water in this part, right? And so you take your witching rod or your divining rod and you'll find the water. Same here. You think or you've heard the story that there was treasure in this field. Now this is the way, right? This is your technical equipment in order to find it. Because you see the treasure will move. And so if the treasure's there, part of what the divining rod will do is help it move. And you see the secret ingredients there are the hen's blood and hog dung. Now why hen's blood and hog dung? Any guesses?
They're readily available,
but there would be other things readily available. Why those two things? One is positive, one is negative. Okay. You think about that in terms of, again, hen's blood and all of that with soothsaying and other kinds of things, and blood in itself. Blood is the force of life. And so therefore, blood is very attractive, supposedly. And your treasure will be moved toward the blood. And what about hog's dung? That's negative. Apparently, and I don't know if we've got olfactory experts here who have done a lot of sniffing, but the sense there is scale of odoriferous dung, hog's dung is nastier than other dungs. Now, I don't know, anybody an expert on that? They can help me out here? But that's my little, the little reading on that. I don't know, you know, if you live around some of these places now, these big hog factory farms and, you know, those tremendous barns that might have, what, 10,000 hogs in them, you know, I remember driving past a few of them, and you certainly know they're there, don't you?
Yes.
So I think that's it. So you see, you've got that treasure in the ground, or you think it's there. And of course, you got to get it to move. And so that treasure, apparently just like us, you know, if it kind of gets a whiff or a scent or some kind of sensation of the hen's blood, going to want to move toward that because life is good in everything. But if it gets a whiff or a scent of the hog's dung, whoa, I'm moving out of here, and it'll move the other way. And then, of course, your divining rods are all going to shimmy and shake and shiver, and you know, ha-ha, I have found the treasure. So that's how you're going to seek it, right? That's your recipe. This is high tech. Or the Icelandic tradition is that of a tide mouse. Has anyone ever heard of this? Tide mouse? Apparently, it's a special kind of or unique kind of mouse. And that when one captures, keeps and properly cares for this creature, and again, right, there's just pages of descriptions of how to do that, it will deliver up for its owner every day one coin of the same value as the first laid under it from the treasure lying on the sea floor. So in other words, this little tide mouse was somehow, you know, there's a shipwreck or something and all the doubloons or whatever have sunk to the bottom. Now, if you're fortunate enough to capture a tide mouse, which is somehow washed up in the sea, you care for it, and what you do is in its little bed that you make for it, you put a, I'm a terrible artist, so we won't even try to think about, right? You put a coin under it, and then each day, the little tide mouse will somehow go down to the sea, get a coin, and bring one back for you. So, you know, every day, you're going to get a coin, and there's your treasure. That's the Icelandic story. Or another way to get treasures, again, in terms of seeking, is to depend on the demons, right? The evil forces or powers to get it for you. And again, here, this is talking about witches and warlocks and sorcerers that can help you to locate treasure. And the first one, these are two incidents that just simply come from court records of medieval England. And I have them because I think they're somewhat funny. And this one is comes from the court record in 1465. In 1465, at the trial of two treasure-digging sorcerers, they were condemned to burning, for they had promised their demon the body of a Christian person. But they cheated him by offering up a cock which they had baptized by a Christian name. Right. So in other words, again, remember, if you were here yesterday, one of the things in hiding, and we think about, again, pirate stories, if you want to hide your treasure so it's protected, you would kill or murder someone and bury them with your treasure, and their ghost would protect the treasure. Now, how are you going to chase that ghost away in order to seek the treasure? Well, the way you do that is, according to what these sorcerers would do, you would kill another person, and that ghost would chase away the other ghost and help you do that. And so that's what these sorcerers were going to do, only they probably chickened out in saying, I'm not really going to kill somebody, so what we'll do is maybe we can fool them if we just baptize this chicken and give it a, you know, and call it Henry, and then it'll be okay. But apparently the religious authorities still thought that was heretical and sacrilegious enough that they were still burned at the stake as heretics. But I don't know. So I just... sixth sense of humor, I guess, about baptizing chickens. Anyway, that's, you can see again, it's a technique. Or the other one, this is from 1611 under the court of King James, same King James that gave us the King James Bible translation. And here he's pardoning someone. He says, in 1611, one William Bate had King James's pardon. And the record states that he was indicted 20 years since for the practicing of invocation of spirits for finding treasure. The ground for this long-deferred grace was that the evidence was found weak. In other words, they all said he could divine spirits to help you find treasure, but no one ever found any treasure from him. So after 20 years in prison, they said, yeah, let him go. He's no good anyway. So there you go. Right. There's some of the things about seeking and the methods that you can use. But then again, we can move down here to things like luck and providence as they come into seeking a treasure. Here's a little story from India, and it goes as following. An impoverished man was on the point of attaching the other end of the rope to his neck to suspend himself, when a voice was heard checking him from his rash act. Desist from your mad resolution. Dig at the root of this tree. You will find 7 pots of gold. Right. So isn't that nice? Life is going rough for you. You're ready to commit suicide. And the voice from heaven says, instead of hanging yourself at this tree, dig at the root of this tree, and voila, gold. Nice. Or another one. This is, again, there's a whole bunch of stories from Spain about Ramon the Discontented. And I'm not quite sure what the analogies are to Ramon, but Ramon is kind of a real jerk, and he's really stupid. Right. Ramon is a stupid, foolhardy gambler who lives in poverty and again is getting ready to hang himself. And so we'll just pick up the story here. As he suspends the rope over the wooden beam, a stream of golden coins came running through the broken end of the hollowed beam. So again, right, you've got this stupid gambler ready to kill himself, and the beam breaks and gold coins come out of it. What a lucky guy. But, right, again, remember, Ramon is really stupid. He gambles all of these things away and again ends up in poverty. And so the story picks up here again. Later, having wasted all this first treasure through foolhardy gambling, he decides to dig a deep hole in the ground and thrust himself in head foremost and stifle himself that way. But in digging the hole, he brings to light a large jar, heavy enough to be full of gold. And so it proved. What's your reaction to
that
story?
What's the moral of that story?
Well, what's your reaction to that story?
Somebody's watching out for him.
Somebody's watching out for him. What else?
Really lucky.
Really lucky. No one's resentful? Right? I mean, okay. Stupid once, right? Fool me once, shame on me. Fool me twice, shame on me, right? I mean, you know, like, Ramon is just... You know, you would think if you would be fortunate enough, lucky enough, providentially enough, the first time to have gotten this treasure, wouldn't you, like, shape up?
Human nature.
Human nature. So whether you win the lottery or not, you would be just as foolish as you always were. Once a stupid gambler, always a stupid gambler, right? Yeah. And that seems to be the case. And again, here perhaps a bit of resentment that goes with it. Or the other thing here is to say again, perhaps, you know, folks, the good things in life, the treasures, will not come your way because of hard work. If you think you're going to be able to work and earn the good life, are you stupid? The smart guy is Ramon the Discontented, who just foolhardily lives, and if it comes your way, it comes your way. And if it doesn't come your way, it isn't going to come your way. That's life.
So much for retirement.
So much for retirement. Right? But I mean, that's kind of the sense there. I mean, that by and large, life is hopeless. And a few of us get lucky.
Unless you've got the Tide Mouse. He's good for
retirement. Unless you got the Tide Mouse.
Annuity.
Yeah, if you can get the Tide Mouse, it'll be different. But other than that, you know, maybe you'll get lucky. And in some senses, we still have that notion if you buy lottery tickets, right? Maybe this time my 1 in 14 million chance will come through or whatever. I don't know. Different way of looking at this. Or again, still a sense of luck and providence. This is one of Aesop's fables. Aesop says, a craftsman had a wooden image of Hermes. And Hermes in Latin for the Romans is the god Mercury. Hermes is the messenger god. He takes all the messages from one god to another. And so every day this man poured libations to it and offered sacrifice, but he continued to fare badly in his business nonetheless. In a fit of anger with the god, he picked up the image by the leg and dashed it to the ground, and from its broken head there poured forth gold. So what's the moral of the story? Remember, Aesop's fables are always told for the sense of a moral. So the moral of the story is...
Inspiration is luck. Hmm? It gives you luck or something?
That what?
Desperation
gives you luck. Yeah. Or what? I mean, what was this man at first? Remember, what did he? Every day he poured libations to the image of Hermes and offered sacrifice, but he continued to fare badly in his business nonetheless. So what? What doesn't get you anywhere?
Hard work.
Hard work, but what's the libations and sacrifice?
Worship.
Worship.
Oh, worship.
Yeah,
worshiping false images?
A false image, or for him it's a god. One, I mean, if we want to put it in a Christian context, you know, all you folks that go to church every Sunday and tithe and sing in the choir and think that that's going to get you a reward. Ha! No, right? Finally, right? He just kind of got disgusted with all of that stuff and smashed the image, and what happened?
He won the lottery.
Luck! He won the lottery. So much for all that religious razzle-dazzle. Don't think that will get you anywhere. It's just going to be, again, pure luck. So, right, don't take Aesop seriously. But no, I mean, that's his thing here. One more on this way of looking at things. And this is a story from Persia. A half-witted fellow living near Baghdad in former times sold his only cow to a chattering bird. And when it flew from its nest in the tree and alighted on a heap of ruins at some little distance, he accordingly dug and found a copper vessel full of gold.
Bird did?
No, the
guy that sold
the half-wit who sold his cow to the bird.
Huh.
Which, right, and I mean, there again, it's It's the humor, the sarcasm, the idiocy of it. I mean, you know, how many people do you know that have sold cows to birds? Maybe some have come close, but probably not quite. Right? So, I mean, again, this is showing this is not someone who you would consider to be thinking clearly at all times. And what happens, and then the bird goes to ruins, right? Again, junk, worthless stuff, garbage, and you dig in the garbage and you find gold. Right? You go up to the second level and start digging in one of those compost bins, and you're going to find a copper vessel filled with gold. Right. Anybody want to go with me and start digging? Right. I mean, sheer luck, providence. As we pay attention again, note the characters, the actors in all of these stories. They're hopeless people. They're stupid people. They're sacrilegious people. They're people who are ready to commit suicide. Right. And they're the ones who discover treasure. Right? As I've said before here, the point of all of these stories seems to be the talking about thrift, hard work, planning, all those kinds of positive values we have toward responsibility, security, everything else. Throw them out the window. They're not going to get you any treasure. Treasure is sheerly by luck. Treasure comes about by providence. And so, therefore, you get the sense of these kinds of people in this sense of seeking that find the treasure. One more, which isn't quite as crazy. And it comes from Norway, and it's called The Silver King. And again, a short little piece here. It reads as follows. There was a man in Western Telemark who was so heavily in debt that he was in danger of losing his farm. As he walked along, wondering what would become of his wife and children, he met an old man to whom he offered some snuff, and the stranger emptied the whole box. Having told his sad tale to the old man, he was invited into his home for the night. When the farmer set out the next morning, the old fellow filled his knapsack with silver and said he was to pay off the debt on his farm with it. There you go. So again, we're starting out with a situation of hopelessness and everything, right? And this poor indebted farmer comes across the old man, and then again, as we pay attention to items in the background, why snuff?
He's a Norwegian. He's a Norwegian.
What's the significance of snuff in the story? It's a luxury item. It's, in that sense, the last small pleasure this little indebted farmer had, right? I mean, again, snuff is a luxury item or an item of pleasure, but of course it doesn't cost much, right? So it's, you know, what's a little advertisement there? Just a pinch between your cheek and gum, right? So a little, or I guess they could probably do the nose thing, but just a little bit of snuff was the little pleasure that this indebted farmer had left. And the old man takes it all. In other words, the symbolism there is whatever little pleasure he was going to have, that's gone too, right? Totally hopeless. And then comes the reversal. From that total hopelessness comes the treasure. Didn't seek it. It was pure luck that he runs into this old man, pure providence that this old man gives him the silver he needs for his treasure. So that here again, the sense is, with all of this, that it highlights in terms of our understanding here, most of the time when you're engaged in seeking, it seems like these are the two items that come into play. That if you're ever really trying to get the treasure, right, purposeful seeking never seems to get you there. It always seems to be luck or providence. Let's go to some Jewish treasure folk tales. And again, the Jewish folk tales take a very different look on the notion of treasure. In terms of, the material that I was working through, this is kind of the Jewish treasure folktale. And others are all variations on it, but this one kind of sets the tone for any way you want to talk about Jewish treasure. And it goes like this. God showed Moses the great treasure troves in which are stored up the various rewards for the pious and the just, explaining each separate one to him in detail. In this one trove were the rewards for those who give alms, in that one for those who bring up orphans. In this way, God showed Moses the destination of each one of the treasures, until at length they came to one of gigantic size. For whom is this treasure? Asked Moses. And God answered, out of the treasures that I have shown thee, I give rewards to those who have deserved them by their deeds. But out of this treasure do I give to those who are not deserving? For I am gracious to those also who may lay no claim to my graciousness, and I am bountiful to those also who are not deserving of my bounty. So what does that tell you? Anyone?
Everyone's treasured.
Everyone's treasured.
I didn't think there was. I thought grace was in the New Testament.
Grace trumps service.
Grace trumps service. That indeed, right, God will reward. God has treasures for those who act morally and responsibly, is right, those who are the alms givers, those who care for the widow and the orphan. But the biggest treasure chest, and the treasures come for the those who also don't deserve it.
Probably because there's more of them.
There's more of them, yeah. Right? I mean, it's not necessarily saying, now that you know that, you know, be an irresponsible oaf, but it is kind of saying these are the facts of life. It's still a realistic look, but it's also an understanding of a gracious God. It's also the understanding that, again, this sense of most of the things that come our way in life will be because of providence, right? And here again, providence within that Jewish tradition would be understood as the graciousness of God. God's providence is what will provide treasures. There's no map. There's no technical apparatus. There's not even a particular moral life that you can live that will guarantee treasure, that will guarantee the success or happiness or salvation or whatever it is you might be seeking. Right? It's much more up in the air. Right? So that there is this sense here that within most of the Jewish treasure stories, if we want to plot this out, there would be a sense of that in some way the treasure, there is that hiding, but there is not seeking, right? Because it doesn't do you any good to do that, but there will still be a finding. And why will you find? This is because of providence. Right? Or, for us, within the Judeo-Christian tradition, we would say, God's grace. So you see, again, not seeking becomes one of those key kind of understandings. All right. With that in mind, if you would turn in your Bibles, please, to Luke chapter 13, verses 1 to 9. Verses 1 to 9. This is Jesus' parable of the barren tree. And I'll read, if you can follow along, please. I'll read my translation of it, how I would try to translate it from the Greek. And also, again, the parable itself doesn't start till verse 6. But those first five verses, setting the context again for it, are very important. Now at the same time, there were some present who reported to him about the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mixed with their sacrifices. And answering, he said to them, "Do you think that because these Galileans suffered, they were worse sinners than all other Galileans? No, I tell you, but unless you repent, you all will perish the same way. Or those 18 who were killed when the Tower of Siloam fell and killed them, do you think that they were worse offenders than all the others dwelling in Jerusalem? No, I tell you, but unless you repent, you all will perish in the same way." Then he told this parable. Someone had a fig tree planted in his vineyard, and he came seeking fruit on it and found none. And he said to the vine dresser, "Look, 3 years I have come seeking fruit on this fig tree, and I did not find any. Cut it down. Why should it render the soil useless?" He answered and said to him, "Boss, leave it even this year until I dig around it and throw on manure. And if it produces fruit, ... Otherwise, if not, you can cut it down. That's the parable and the context. First of all, what will help us in understanding this parable and what's going on and why we would be talking about treasure is to talk a little bit about fig trees. All you Bible experts, what do you know about fig trees in the Bible? Where do we first encounter a fig tree? Eden. And what story in Eden do we have with fig trees?
Well, there were fig leaves.
There's fig leaves, that's right. In Genesis chapter 3, Adam and Eve, right, they eat the fruit. So now they're in trouble, and they make themselves their little loincloths, their little underwear from fig tree leaves, from fig leaves. So in that sense already, the fig tree there, you see, is a sense of something that provides things for you. But it's also a little ironic in terms of the story of fig leaves. We've got for ourselves here a little bit of Hebrew humor, because the consistency or texture of a fig leaf is very, very rough and scratchy. The best sense I can have in terms of comparison to a fig leaf is like Velcro. You know, right? So now think about this, all right? Here's the humor. Adam and Eve are naked and they're ashamed, and so they're going to make for themselves a little Velcro underwear. Anyone want to wear Velcro underwear for the day? Not a pleasant feeling. But you see, that's precisely the point, isn't it? Sin is kind of chafing and irritating. And to be a sinner is like wearing Velcro underwear. So that, if you will, the fig tree here can function as both a blessing, because you've got the leaves, you've got something there to cover your nakedness, but at the same time, it's already part of the curse. You know? The good news is I'm not naked. The bad news is it's Velcro underwear. Right? And so again, right, I mean, I guess, given my choices, standing in front of you naked or wearing Velcro underwear, well, we'd probably go with the Velcro underwear. But it's not a pretty picture. Right? That's it. And throughout the scriptures, fig trees function as that sense of blessing and curse. Fruitful fig trees are always understood as blessing. They are indeed a treasure. And when Israel rebels against God, and when Israel is disobedient toward God, then indeed the fig tree will not bear fruit. It will be barren. It will be empty. Right? Cursed will be the vine. Cursed will be the fig tree because of Israel's sin against God. And you can find that kind of understanding about fig trees, fruitful, our treasure, right, not fruitful, a curse because of the people's behavior, just all over in the Old Testament. That's part of what's going on. So that we can see here that this is the parable that we have here is a treasure story, because the fig tree symbolizes treasure, or positively speaking, again, in for the Hebrew, for the Jewish people, the fig tree is the symbol of peace, prosperity, and security. And isn't that what a treasure should always provide us, right? If I have treasure, I have peace, prosperity, and security. And so here, in this little parable, we have the owner of the orchard, the vineyard and orchard, is coming out, right, seeking a fruitful fig tree. He's seeking his treasure of peace, prosperity, security. Does he find it? No. He finds a barren fig tree. How does this work? Other Jewish stories about this. Here's one again, talking about the fig tree and fruit. It comes from the Mishnah. Rabbi Hiyah and his disciples were accustomed to rise early and sit under a certain fig tree, the owner of which used to rise early to gather its fruit. Said they, "Perhaps he suspects us of taking his fruit. Let us change our place." Accordingly, they changed their place. He then went to them and said, "My masters, this one merit that ye had conferred upon me by sitting and studying under my fig tree, ye have now deprived me of it." "We thought perhaps you suspected us," they replied. But he reassured them, and they returned to their original place. What did he do? He did not gather its fruit in the morning, whereupon the figs became wormy. Said they, "The owner of the fig tree knows when their fruit is ripe for plucking, and he plucks it. In the same way, the Holy One, blessed be he, knows when the time of the righteous has come, whereupon he removed them. What is the proof? My beloved is gone down to his garden." Song of Solomon, chapter 6, verse 2. What that little story tells us there, and how it fits in with the context of this story, is again, you've got a fig tree, and right, the rabbis are studying under the fig tree. Why? Because it's a symbol of blessing and prosperity. Also, it's one of the trees that in that terrain provides the most shade, so the rabbis are there under it. But, right, the owner of the fig tree always goes out and picks his figs before the rabbis sit under it. And so the rabbis are thinking, well, this guy thinks he's coming out early to pick all his figs because he thinks once we're here, right, we're going to be picking all his figs. So, you know, well, we're upright good rabbis, so we'll just go find another fig tree and not bother him. But he says, no, that's not it at all. Come on back. He doesn't pick the fig trees early but late. They get wormy. They're bad. The rabbis now figure it out. Ah, you see, there's a time and a place for everything. So, why were those Galileans massacred and their blood mingled with sacrifices? Why did the Tower of Siloam fall on those 18 folks? It was their time. The symbolism there is plucking of the figs is symbolic of God plucking you from this life when the time is right. So don't talk about, you know, these folks deserved or didn't deserve it, that they were worse sinners than anyone else. It's again this sense of providence and everything. It is your time. And so that's how it works. Now, Jesus, in telling this parable too, is going to, again, provide us with a little twist and say, well, it isn't going to quite work this way. Indeed, what happens when the tree is barren? And thinking about this, the way the story goes and the practice again of growing a fig tree, the first 3 years, there shouldn't be any fruit at all. So you leave it alone for 3 years. Let me just put this on the board here so we get our math right. The first 3 years, you leave it alone. The next year, and this is a passage from Leviticus, says, the next year the fruit should still be considered unclean. You don't pick it. After that, now you can gather fruit. So you would say you've got 3 years, you leave it alone for 1 year. Our story tells us the guy's been coming out for 3 more years, so you will, right, 7 years on this tree, no fruit. So we can be quite confident that what we must call this tree is dead, right? Infertile. You're not going to get anything off of this tree. And then comes the gardener and says, no, let it go a little more. Let me throw some manure around it. Greek word for that, copria. It's a nasty term. This is our PG-13 moment here. If you're really going to translate it, this is saying shit. Right. And it's also a slang term for people. Right. So that if it would be the kind of people we were talking about, like Ramon the Discontented. Ramon the Discontented is, if you will, it's the best thing I can think of, and maybe you can think of different terms. Ramon the Discontented is a dumb shit, right? You're not just shit, but you're a dumb shit. You don't get much worse than a dumb shit, right? And I'm sure you all know some of those dumb shits in the world. Right. Or perhaps another phrase is something like scum of the earth, right? And so there's the kind of thing there that again, this is humor. In telling this parable, you know, Jesus is quite the joker, right? So that the gardener is here and Jesus or the gardener is saying to his boss, he said, well, let me throw a few dumb shits on it. Maybe that'll help it, right? Maybe it won't. And, right, the master says, okay. And then, right, the gardener says, and then we'll see. Right? And the New Revised Standard Version in verse 9 says, if it bears fruit next year, well and good. But if not, you can cut it down. Okay. That little phrase there, well and good, that's where I would say, you know, if it bears fruit next year, the Greek, again, is eisteon melon, which is basically their way of providing an ellipsis, right? To translate that is really dot, dot, dot. In other words, the gardener is saying, and if it bears fruit, and if not, cut it down. Right. And so the well and good is the translator's way of trying to go, which is kind of hard to do in print, right? But it's that ellipsis. And that's the whole point of the parable. But what's this trying to tell us? Why? Right, remember, fig trees, blessing or curse, right, the treasure. This tree is no treasure, right? It's probably dead. So, what are we talking about here?
Miracle?
Miracle. Utter providence, utter grace. Right? I think the point of the story is, in some senses, and trying to link it up with what Diane Jacobson said in the Bible study this morning, if you were here for that, and the whole question about evil, and you know, evil. Sometimes it's out there and it just happens. Or as I think Jesus is trying to tell us here, you know, folks, shit happens. But the other side of it is, and you know, folks, grace happens. Providence, God's grace happens. And you know, it might just like to link it back to our other, you know, just as it happened to Ramon the discontented, just as it happened to that poor guy in India who was going to hang himself but was said, nah, dig at the root of the tree and voila, 7 pots of gold. Just as it happened to that indebted Norwegian farmer who lost all of his snuff and finally got the silver to pay the debt on the farm, so even to us barren trees, grace may happen. Right? Who knows? Who knows? Right? We're living, in other words, Jesus' sense here is, we're living in the ellipsis. We're living in that shrug time, that who knows time. It seems hopeless. To think that things are really going to get better seems to be fantasy. And yet, who knows? Grace happens, doesn't it? Trees can be fruitful, can't they? Somebody finds treasure, don't they? Who knows? Okay. You see, it's not seeking. I can't give you the recipe, like the divining rod thing is, for finding your treasure. I can't give you the recipe for how to get forgiven, how to earn God's favor, how to be treasured or whatever, peace, prosperity, security, health and wealth, gospel, whatever. Can't give it to you. All I can say is, there's a gracious God. Who knows what those treasures will be for you? I think that's for this parable, this sense about treasure is in terms of when we emphasize a notion of seeking. Any comments or that your our time is up, please feel free to go if you need to do other things or whatnot, but if you want to comment on this a little bit. Right? I mean, it's the paradox of seeking without finding, finding without seeking, right? Who knows what treasures may come your way from the gracious God? Thank you.